Open your ears
to real alternative radio. Co-op Radio goes back to its big corporate sponsors for more money, commercials, and a list of things not to say.
Not this radio station.
And now for something completely different.
Be the big corporation. Back your own radio station. CFRO 102.7 FM's
New Wrinkles.
Border Radio.
Star Craven. Future Past.
Special stuff for your head. Keep it on the air. Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Join us.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
On CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Hello and welcome to Radio EcoShock. Are you tired of those old, unreliable nuclear weapons hanging around in your silos and submarines? Just as most of us are trying hard not to think about what a loose nuke could do to a city, George Bush wants to make thousands of new ones. In fact, the New York Times reports his administration wants to reinvigorate the weapons design labs and come out with a green-sounding hybrid design, something the generals can count on. After years of protesting the complete insanity of nuclear weapons, remember those peace marches? George Bush wants to make sure a new generation gets to live under the threat of a mushroom cloud. The Americans will spend $100 billion to make new model warheads, even though studies by the Union of Concerned Scientists showed the existing weapons will still be able to incinerate a city full of people even 100 years from now. The United States may even resume underground testing, despite the international ban. Meanwhile, a British newspaper reports Israel plans to drop a nuclear weapon on a uranium enrichment facility in Iran. Just a little nuke, mind you. The Muslim world will hardly notice. When this kind of news drives me crazy, there's only one thing to do. I called up one of the sanest voices amid the madness, Dr. Helen Caldicott. She's been a driving force behind the anti-nuclear movement for decades and recently began a whole new campaign, saying this is no time to relax about the nuclear threat. I reached her at her home in Australia, and that's coming up next. In the second part of the show, we'll try to get more positive about the other most depressing news of the world, climate change. After plenty of warning from the world's top scientists, we're starting to hear about solutions that could save the climate as we know it. I'll be reviewing the five best speeches of 2006 on solutions to global warming from people like Al Gore, Lester Brown, Amory Lovins, George Monbiot, and Ross Gelbspan. Then I'll tell you where you can download these speeches for free. There are answers. As voters and consumers, you need to know how to prevent climate catastrophe. But let's start with Dr. Caldicott in this exclusive interview with Radio EcoShock. We're speaking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, the longtime critic of nuclear power and especially the madness of nuclear weapons. Her latest book is Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. Dr. Caldicott, on January 7th, the New York Times published an article titled U.S. Selecting Hybrid Design for Warheads. Apparently, the Bush regime has sanctioned the construction of new nuclear weapons instead of the disarmament that was the hope of millions. And this is all in the name of safety. What do you make of all this?
This is nothing new. There have been plans on the drawing board for some years now called the Stockpile Stewardship and Maintenance Program to be taken place at the nuclear weapons labs, namely Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore. It was apparently to upgrade the weapons to make sure they were reliable, i.e. that they would land exactly on target, and b. that they would explode with the kilotonnage or megatonnage with which they were designed to do. However, the truth is, if you read my second to last book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, the labs are involved and have been for some years now in a program which is building, designing, testing and developing brand new nuclear weapons. So this article that came out on the 7th of January in the New York Times really is reporting nothing new. It's just that people don't realize that these activities are ongoing.
And they're called reliable replacement warheads. Doesn't that underline what many have been saying all along, that the thousands of nuclear weapons are unsafe wherever they are and could be grabbed by terrorists as well?
Well, the new nuclear weapons are unsafe and can be grabbed by terrorists as well if they go ahead as designed and are built. They talk about reliability, and they're worried that the plutonium, which is the fuel for the nuclear weapon, will degrade over time. But a new study has shown that the plutonium remains reliable and will explode as planned for the next 100 years. The Jasons, who are a scientific group who oversee the labs, continuously say that the reliability is absolutely more than 90%, maybe 99%. And so it's a subterfuge. It's what they're really doing is building new nuclear weapons under the guise of reliability. The old weapons are reliable, but the truth is that now the Cold War's over, these weapons should be eliminated. Well, they should never have been built. Of the 30,000 hydrogen bombs in the world today, 30,000, America and Russia own 97% of them. They still target each other on hair trigger alert with thousands of bombs on their missiles ready to go at any second on any day. And the Pentagon still maintains a policy to fight and win a preemptive secret nuclear war against Russia. So that we live on the edge of nuclear catastrophe more so now than we did during the height of the Cold War.
But why would the Bush regime be pushing for new nuclear weapons?
Because they want to keep the labs in operation. They want the fellows to be paid to design new nuclear weapons. They want new scientists to enter the workforce of the weapons designers and builders. They want the labs to be kept open for no real reason. I mean, you ask me that question, it's really a rhetorical question, to which I have no adequate response except to say that I think subliminally this is an indication of power and control and prestige of the nuclear weapons labs and their scientists. That's all.
And these new weapons have never been tested, and the Times claims Robert Joseph, the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, has said the White House shouldn't make any commitment about testing the weapon underground. And I thought the American government was already committed to ending nuclear testing.
Now, there's been talk over the last few years, because of what the labs are doing, about actually reintroducing real nuclear weapons testing. In fact, they are testing weapons as I speak, not to produce nuclear explosions per se, but simulated nuclear explosions underground. They're testing, quote, the hydrodynamics of plutonium just before it explodes with huge computerized experiments. But if they build new weapons of a totally new design, they will be really obliged to test them in their minds. So that the complete test ban treaty that Kennedy brought into effect, which it's only a partial test ban treaty, sorry, it's a complete test ban treaty, will be violated, and they'll start testing again. I think if the Bush administration and the labs are allowed to get away with what they're doing at the moment.
Well, I'd like to move on to another imminent danger. The Sunday Times has reported that Israel plans to use so-called mini-nukes to destroy an Iranian enrichment facility deep underground. And some claim these nuclear bombs would be 1/15 the size of that dropped on Hiroshima. Where would Israel get such a weapon?
Israel has, some say, the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world. They've got between 200 and 400 hydrogen bombs. I'm surprised you asked that question because I thought it was common knowledge. They have always refused to confirm or deny they have nuclear weapons, although the other day Prime Minister Olmert made a mistake and actually admitted that Israel does have nuclear weapons. Everybody knows they do, and so they've got lots of weapons at their disposal.
Well, I suppose my thinking was that it's been the United States who have been bragging about their bunker busters and nuclear tactical nukes. I was wondering whether Israel might get it directly from the United States, as they do so many other weapons.
Oh, no, I think that they've built their own weapons. You're right, they certainly do develop many of the new weapons that the Pentagon is about to build. Actually, they often build them before the Pentagon has built them. They have spies, they have personnel, within the Pentagon, and they're way ahead in weapons development and design, ahead of the Pentagon in many cases.
And what changes would you see to the world's nuclear landscape if Israel or the United States uses the first nuclear weapon in anger since Nagasaki in 1945?
It would be an absolute total catastrophe, because it would say that Israel and America, or America, are prepared to use nuclear weapons, giving the green light for any other countries to use nuclear weapons. And there are countries who may well do that, including Pakistan and India, who got to within really hours of having a nuclear war in 1999 over the dispute over the Kashmir border. Australia is selling uranium now to Taiwan and to China, and that's a dispute which is ongoing, and Taiwan could well make nuclear weapons from the uranium and from the nuclear facilities fueled by Australian uranium. There are hot spots in the world now where if America and Israel use nuclear weapons, and incidentally millions could be killed from the fallout, there's been a study done by Physicians for Social Responsibility. So medically it would be a total catastrophe, internationally a total catastrophe, and also if weapons are used in this case, it could invoke enormous international anxiety. We have a man in the White House now who I would say is not exactly emotionally stable. And under such circumstances, mistakes are made. And it could trigger a nuclear holocaust between Russia and America by accident or by human fallibility. So we're talking about many levels of a problem which is ongoing and which has never been solved and never been fixed.
Many people seem to be tuning out anything nuclear, thinking the danger has gone away and it is so frightening. How could we re-energize the anti-nuclear movement to these grave and continuing dangers?
That's a good question. I think that people got terribly sick and tired of thinking about nuclear war during the 80s, and when the Cold War ended, they thought, thank God, it's all over. It's true, they need to be re-energized. The anti-nuclear movement needs to become powerful yet again. I suppose I would suggest that people read my last two books, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military Industrial Complex, to catch up on the incredible nuclear nightmare that still exists between Russia and America and could trigger a Holocaust tonight or tomorrow. And they should read my next book called Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, about the resurgence of the nuclear industry saying they're the answer to global warming, which they are not. Then I think that if you become well informed, read those books and really understand and learn what's in them, you will become re-energized. You will have a huge amount of information and you will work out what you are going to do. Canada is part of NORAD and is part of the First Strike Nuclear War System. You have a huge responsibility to the world. You could take the lead and remove yourselves from NORAD, as New Zealand removed itself, not from the ANZUS Treaty, but prevented nuclear weapons entering their harbours from America years ago and suffered no ill effects. Canadians could take the lead in sort of moving the world towards sanity and survival in this very dangerous nuclear era.
And you have a couple of websites, do you? Can you tell our listeners what they are?
Yes. The website, the operative website for my institute is called nuclearpolicy.org. That's for the Nuclear Policy Research Institute in Washington. And my personal website is helencaldicott.com.
And finally, when I read about presidents and generals discussing the need to make more weapons so they could incinerate millions of people at a time, it's really difficult to suppress my rage, and you are at the focus of this urge. How do you survive this madness and keep on going?
I think at the moment I practice a degree of psychic numbing. I know all the facts. I write about it consistently. I'm thoroughly involved in it, but I block out my emotions. Until yesterday, when a man turned up who's making a film about what is happening in Australia in terms of uranium and nuclear power and storage of foreign radioactive waste, and I suddenly became profoundly depressed when I let it in. Australia's at a very horrifying sort of crossroads at the moment with a very dangerous Prime Minister who's totally pro-nuclear. I work a lot in my garden. I suppose the real answer to your question is that if I didn't do this work, I would become extremely depressed and have nightmares, so that I have a sense that if I do the work, I'm helping to fix the situation. Whether I am or not is a different question. But it seems to satisfy my psyche that at least I'm being constructive and not destructive by denying or ignoring reality.
Well, I think that's a good answer for all of us, and we've been speaking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, and thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, and good luck to all of you. I think we're at a very important turning point in the history of the human race.
We are. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye.
You are tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. After a little song, we'll be reviewing the five best climate speeches of 2006. The authors and organizers who explain their plans to stop runaway climate change. This is Jerry Dempsey with Some Misgivings.
My name is Harry, Dick, or Tom. Somebody put me in control of the bomb. I just sit by the phone and wait for the call, so I can press the button and blow us all to kingdom come. Oh, bury me in 6 feet of lead. I may be cold, but I won't be dead. I'll be radiating poison into the atmosphere, killing every living thing in the northern hemisphere. I didn't mind about the millions dead. I was more concerned about my standard of living. But when the TV packed in and the lights went dead, I began to get some misgivings. There's something nice about a mushroom cloud, especially when you're tired of being one of the crowd. No more football fans, no more shopping queues. It's back to nature for the lucky few. But where is nature? It can't be found. Everybody left is living underground, waiting for the fallout to fall on them, waiting for the credits and the caption saying the end. I didn't mind about the millions dead. I was more concerned about my standard of living. But when the TV packed in and the lights went dead, I began to get some misgivings.
If you have suggestions, local green news, or comments about the show, you can email us at radio@ecoshock.org or visit our website at www.ecoshock.org. You can also get our features podcast directly to your computer and download past CFRO shows and interviews. Lately, Vancouver experienced the strangest weather. First it's hot, then it snows, and record winds have blown down thousands of trees, some 300 years old. That's got to tell you something. Howling gusts blew holes in the roof of our big stadium and half-wrecked the famous Stanley Park. It tossed metal and branches all over the roads. At least 250,000 people lost electricity, many for several days. You would almost think the climate has become unstable. Worried about climate change? Where are the plans to solve this crisis? This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock with a review of the five best climate solution speeches of 2006. I'll also tell you where you can get those speeches for free. Let's see what practical steps we can take to avert climate catastrophe. Will it be a happy or a grim new year? In 2006, the Arctic melted more, rains fell heavier, fires burned bigger, the plants and animals were confused by a changing climate. This was the year polls showed the public is getting it. People are worried, and unlikely characters and corporations are calling themselves green. It was also the year of plans to avert climate catastrophe. Most of these proposals did not come from governments who are still, with a few exceptions, in paralysis or denial. The visionaries are self-appointed, yet generally they are world-watching veterans and professional communicators. We are talking about Al Gore, the former politician, Amory Lovins, a Green gone big time, British journalist sensation George Monbiot, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigator Ross Gelbspan, the official World Watcher, Lester Brown, and perhaps urban critic James Howard Kunstler with the Peak Oil Movement. Radio EcoShock has assembled their latest speeches on how to get out of the heat in a special section of free downloads at www.ecoshock.org. Of course, there is an official plan of sorts. The Kyoto Protocol was organized by world governments, prodded on by the world's largest group of peer-reviewed, climate-related scientists. It is a start, but half-dead without the world's biggest atmospheric polluter, the United States. Kyoto expires in 2012. It doesn't have teeth to really accomplish much. Most governments give Kyoto lip service only, while actually increasing their greenhouse gas pollution. Beyond Kyoto, there is only the recent failed Nairobi Climate Conference and an agreement to talk more. When it comes to the big reduction really needed to have any impact on human-induced climate change, proponents of the Kyoto Protocol admit this plan won't save us. At the other extreme from the governments are the survivalists, whose only plan is to grow local food, get off the grid, and wait for the crash. We might include urban critics like James Howard Kunstler and the Peak Oil crowd. They think oil and gas supplies will dwindle even as world demand multiplies. They may be right, but if we just burn the remainder, the climate will spin out of control long before oil shortage forces a major social adjustment. Worse, humans might just use even more coal, and there is plenty of coal. One of the best Peak Oil sites is www.globalpublicmedia.com. Still others think big climate change is already upon us. Plans to limit CO2, to stop even worse heat and storms, may be needed, but we also require more urgent plans just to survive it. For example, James Lovelock is calling for new dikes to protect the City of London and much of the southern English coast from the ravages of rising seas and strong storms. New Orleans and New York also need protection. Most of the less developed low-lying countries, such as Bangladesh, may be unable to mount any climate defenses in time. We also have the plans of geoengineers. One example, the people who would shoot gazillions of tiny mirrors into outer space to block some of the sun's rays and thus cool off the Earth. I can't go into all those plans here, but George Monbiot offers this important caution. Even if we could succeed with such a wild space adventure and cool down the sun without damaging the natural world, we would still have to turn off the carbon smokestacks. That's because all that carbon is being absorbed by the ocean, and that makes the ocean so acidic that basic life forms, like plankton, may not survive. It's not just the heat. We have to reduce the impact of carbon on the oceans as well. Today, you and I are going to rumble through five plans to avert climate catastrophe, from people serving as spark plugs for the public mind. Let's start with the most famous man in climate change, Al Gore Jr. The former vice president, and almost president of the United States, needs no formal introduction. And he has real climate credentials. Gore began his climate fixation as a convert in college under the scientist Roger Revell. Al Gore brought the issue to government very early and published his book Earth in Balance in 1992. Al Gore is now known for his movie presentation, An Inconvenient Truth. There is also a book version published by Rodale Books. But since that unlikely bestseller, Gore has graduated from warning about climate change to a grassroots plan to push the American and world public into demand for change. As a whole chorus of people convert to climate reality through inconvenient truth, Gore has become a kind of clearinghouse and meeting place. He's part Hollywood and a mixture of scientists, businessmen, and believers who want a new vision of not just America, but the world energy economy. What is Al Gore's plan? First of all, Gore continues his initial role of awakening millions of people to the awful truth we face as the climate becomes unhinged. He used part of his profits earned by the movie and personal appearances to create a new institute called the Alliance for Climate Protection, based in San Francisco. As the new year of 2007 arrived, about 1,000 volunteer communicators assembled for a combination pep talk, media training, and grassroots organizing of inconvenient parties. These will be local events and may be large or living room size, like climate Tupperware parties. They aim to move people from worry to action. These will be, well, the new evangelists or agents of social change to save the Earth's climate as we know it. In recent speeches, Gore has also outlined a larger political plan centered in America but reaching the whole world. It is essentially a Made in America plan to sell to U.S. voters. Gore envisions a revamping of the failing U.S. industrial sector to produce prodigious amounts of alternative carbon-free energy tech. These mass-produced solar panels, windmills, and super-efficient vehicles will fill the freighters that currently leave American ports empty, having disgorged their load of consumer goods. As reported in the Washington Post of September 19, 2006, and in Gore's speech, Solving the Climate Crisis, he proposes a carbon-neutral mortgage association. This would let homeowners stretch out the increased costs of more insulation, solar panels, and energy-efficient houses as part of the mortgage, and these costs should pay for themselves as energy bills will be less. Gore also wants to revamp the electricity distribution system to let homeowners and business sell their own electricity back to the grid. He calls it the Electronet.
Here is just one of a series of proposals made by Al Gore in his September 2006 speech, Solving the Climate Crisis.
Shifting to a greater reliance on ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, butanol, and green diesel fuels will not only reduce global warming pollution and enhance our national security and economic security, it will also reverse the steady loss of jobs and income in rural America. Several important building blocks for our solutions to the climate crisis can be found in new approaches to agriculture. As pointed out by the 25 by 25 movement, aimed at securing 25% of America's power and transportation fuels from agricultural sources by the year 2025, we can revitalize the farm economy by shifting its mission from a focus on a traditional focus on food, feed, and fiber to a focus on food, feed, fiber, fuel, and ecosystem services. We can restore the health of depleted soils by encouraging and rewarding the growing of fuel source crops like switchgrass and sawgrass using no-till cultivation, scientific crop rotation. We should reward farmers for planting more trees and sequestering more carbon and recognize the economic value of their stewardship of resources that are important to the health of the ecosystems that support our lives.
Like several other climate planners we will meet, Gore sees our carbon fix as a challenge that can save rather than wreck America. Alternative energy will end dependence on oil from unstable regions, make the U.S. self-sufficient, and rebuild its manufacturing preeminence. At the same time, this new tech renaissance will give energy to billions of people in the developing world without harming the world's atmosphere. Unlike other speakers we will meet, Gore doesn't go into the details of how this transfer of new wealth will take place. Gore's plan targets America and may well be part of a political platform for himself or others in the 2008 elections.
and everyone knows America certainly needs a plan, an exit strategy from the deadly carbon fix. Let's move to another long-timer, Lester Brown, the founder of World Watch Institute. Brown is almost an institutional environmentalist. For more than two decades, he has been counting up the world's resources and identifying trends. His statistics have been used by people with widely different agendas. He perceives Earth as a limited system with finite resources that dwindle not only as human population grows, but as those humans adopt more consumerism. In 2004, Brown proposed what he calls Plan B. Our present direction, Plan A, isn't working. Lester Brown has a relatively comprehensive alternative direction that employs existing institutions, whether governments, banks, or large nonprofits. He relies on reforming trade and agriculture, for example, rather than counting on new technology or a radical change in our social system. One of the key indicators pursued by the World Watch Institute under Lester Brown was world grain stocks. Both production and backup supplies of grain are falling due to water shortages, soil depletion, increased population pressure, and climate change. In many parts of the world, such as the grain-growing areas of India, the crop depends on pumping fossil water from long ago from ever-falling water tables. His Plan B calls for three major changes of direction. First of all, we must learn to use water much more efficiently all over the planet. This includes recycling wastewater in the world's megacities. Agriculture needs to use seasonal rains rather than draining aquifers. None of that works without reducing the pressure of new population. We're adding between 75 and 100 million new mouths to feed every year, and we have already bypassed sustainable food production. Brown's third vector of change is to cut carbon emissions in half in the next 10 years to preserve the climate. His book, Plan B, describes various tools we can use, from new fossil fuels, conservation, and rethinking society. Here is a clip from Lester Brown's speech, Plan B.
The residential electricity needs of 40 million Europeans are being satisfied by wind-generated electricity. Now, the European Wind Energy Association last November projects that by 2020, 16 years from now, half of Europe could be getting its residential electricity from wind power. In March of this year, a European wind energy consulting firm said that if European governments get serious about developing their offshore wind capacity, that by 2020, Europe could be getting all of its residential electricity needs from wind. It's a huge resource. In the United States, there are now commercial wind farms in 22 states, that is, commercial wind farms feeding electricity into the grid. In 1991, the U.S. Department of Energy did a national wind resource inventory in which they pointed out that three of our 50 states, North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national electricity needs. And people said, wow, because many people thought wind was a marginal source of energy. In retrospect, we now know that that was a great underestimate because it was based on the wind turbine technologies of 1991. Advances in wind turbine design since then enable wind turbines to operate at lower wind speeds, to convert wind into electricity more efficiently, and they harvest a much larger regime, because whereas the average wind turbine in 1991 was probably 120 feet tall, the new ones going in today are 300 feet tall. Not only is it a larger regime, but the wind is much stronger up here than it is closer to the land surface. We can probably say today that those three states have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national energy needs. Wind is a huge resource.
We can count Lester Brown among the macro thinkers who is concerned not only with climate, but with a wide range of problems facing the human project. However, like almost all our planners in this series, his emphasis is on humanity rather than the whole range of species on Earth now facing extinction due to climate change. At a different pole of society, Amory Lovins is an American environmentalist and experimenter who definitely believes that new technology could save us from climatic wreck. This is a man who goes to the high places of Colorado and builds an experimental home workshop to test out alternative energy and lifestyles. He claims to grow bananas in the winter in a home without any central heating system. The passive house he inhabits with his wife, Hunter Lovins, grabs heat from the ground and the sun and never lets it go. Lovins was a longtime environmental activist, but in the last 15 years, he has risen into the elite circles of big business and even the Pentagon. This is the Answers Man, Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, speaking on PBS's Charlie Rose Show on November 29th, 2006.
Amory Lovins is here. He is the founder and CEO of the Rocky Mountain Institute, which is dedicated to energy research. For the last 30 years, he's been at the forefront of research into new and sustainable forms of energy. Once dismissed as crazy or irrelevant, his ideas are now being embraced by major corporations and governments. He is now an advisor to both Walmart and the Pentagon. In 2004, he co-authored a book called Winning the Oil Endgame, which was sponsored by the Pentagon. He is the recipient of numerous awards and honors for his work, including a MacArthur Genius Grant. I am pleased to have him here at this table for the first time. Welcome. And so by the year 2050, you think we could, which is 44 years from now, mm-hmm. you believe that we will what?
We could be completely off oil in this country at about a fifth the cost of buying it.
Yeah.
We could get, by the way, 1 million new jobs and save 1 million old jobs that way, get rid of a quarter of our carbon dioxide emissions that cause global weirding. And we'd make a very handsome return, which is why that transition beyond oil can be led by business for profit. We're helping that happen now. We could also have largely or wholly phased out the emissions that are changing the climate. And we'd make money on the deal because it's cheaper to save fuel than to buy fuel. Decentralized renewables, sun, wind, and the rest. And those actually added last year 4 times as much new electricity and about 11 times as much generating capacity as nuclear added. And yet the nuclear folks will tell you these are small, slow, futuristic, decades from being competitive. Well, actually, it's their central power plants, coal, nuclear, gas,
right.
that probably by now have less than half the world market in providing those electrical services for the world, because both negawatts saving electricity and micropower have taken at least the other half of the market. Nobody noticed.
Lovins has helped design ultra-light cars using carbamate instead of steel that use very little fuel. He investigates the most stingy energy mechanisms and then looks for real-world applications. His work has penetrated into the labs of General Motors, although apparently that car company didn't listen or follow through. Amory's most recent big report was co-produced by the Pentagon. The American military is deadly serious about a future that doesn't require fighting in the Middle East for oil. They want a fighting army, Air Force and Navy, that generate their own energy and don't depend on anyone else. Although Lovins has been an outspoken critic of both nuclear weapons and nuclear power, he hasn't shrunk from working with the U.S. military. Perhaps this is appropriate since the military uses up to half the oil Americans import. It takes a lot of black juice to ship, fly, or drive all that equipment, the weapons, and the people all over America and the world. Reform there might actually help save the planet. Lovin's technical plans might make a more efficient world. His talks and ideas are exciting. In fact, he and Hunter Lovins propose a new model for capitalism, which they call natural capitalism. as a horrible simplification of a complex idea, we can say natural capitalism involves including the cost of nature in corporate bookkeeping. It attempts a money-making world that can profit from such challenges as natural shortages or even climate change. So there is a very large political and economic idea coming from the Lovins camp. We may wonder whether greed can really save the world, but short of outright revolution into completely unknown territory, some modification of capitalism is definitely required when it comes to climate change. Perhaps Lovins' proposals are just 20 or 100 years ahead of their time. We don't know. Let's get out of America and across the Atlantic to a European perspective, another journalist and book writer with a plan. George Monbiot has finished his initial book tour to promote Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. Unlike Amory Lovins, Monbiot insists on using technology we have today to solve our problems. He points out the scientific consensus that time is short. To balance the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, in time to avert catastrophic climate change, we need to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by at least 50% by the year 2030. And if we assume that the rest of the world's population, especially in China and India, are growing toward lifestyle standards similar to our own, we will have to share that energy and other resources much more evenly than in our colonial and corporate colonial past. According to Monbiot, who cites experts he has interviewed and papers studied, that means people in the developed world must reduce our carbon emissions by a staggering 90% by 2030. That will leave just enough emissions for the developing countries to reach a reasonable living standard, development, and technology. In a sense, we need to emit much less so they can emit a bit more while they build up infrastructure, housing, and a modern economy. Monbiot investigates the various major categories of energy use in Western-style life. These include such things as heavy industry, electric power generation, and transportation. His speeches so far deal less with industry, other than a 90% reduction across the board. We presume he means alternative energy, collecting carbon dioxide for underground storage, and the like. We may have to do without certain products and processes that create climate havoc with their emissions. His plan has more detail when it comes to electricity generation. Monbiot can tolerate nuclear power as preferable to roasting without life as we know it, but he doesn't think reactors can be built in time to save us, and unlike Gaia founder James Lovelock, he doesn't see nuclear power as the answer to our big problems. Monbiot is also dismissive of small-scale electric generation as a solution to anything. A recent column in the Guardian newspaper derided Greens who mount wind generators or small solar panels on their houses. He doesn't even like distributed small-scale power systems. Let's think really big, he says, and build monster-scale alternative energy plants. He wants offshore wind farms with thousands of gigantic rotors, similar to the recent mega wind project recently proposed to help power the city of London. But Monbiot advocates using DC, direct current, to carry this alternative energy for very long distances, thousands of kilometers, with much less power loss than our alternating AC current. Using new technology for these DC cables, he foresees grabbing vast areas of the Sahara Desert for solar farms to power Europe and Africa. Meanwhile, Monbiot would rethink and retool simple transportation systems like the Humble Bus. The new bus system would operate only on existing highways. A big fleet of deluxe and comfortable buses would run constantly between towns and cities, on the highway, loading and unloading at terminals right at the off-ramps. You would reach these terminals by fast-moving mass transit from the city, like light rail or subways. The buses themselves never move into towns, where they bog down, but just move people between major locations. By being more convenient, safer, and almost a leisure-time experience instead of a frightening rush hour, these buses would soak up the inhabitants of private automobiles, mainly replacing the car. The energy savings are enormous, and emissions could drop to the required 90% of current levels,
without giving up our ability to get around. There are many more good ideas like this in his book, Heat. Here is another proposal from George Monbiot.
It's not my own idea, but it's the one which I think makes the most sense, and this is a carbon rationing system. In concept, it's very simple. The government says this is what our total emissions for this year should be, and every year they get lower. And then we divide that total into two blocks, one of 40% of the emissions, the other of 60%. The 40% corresponds to the energy that we use directly when we are buying electricity and gas, when we pay our electricity and gas bills, when we buy gasoline to put in our cars, when we buy plane tickets and train tickets. The other 60%, that's the energy which is used on our behalf by corporations, and that 60% is auctioned off to those corporations by the government, which should do pretty well out of that auction. The 40%, which is that which we use directly, is divided by the number of people in the country, and we all get an equal share of it. And you get a carbon debit card, and every time you pay your natural gas bill or your electricity bill or fill up your tank with gasoline, you hand over your card and a little bit of your carbon ration gets taken off that card. If you run out before the end of the year, it's not the end of the world for you, but to carry on using energy, you must buy some surplus carbon ration from someone who's used less than their full ration. Because the rich tend to use more energy than the poor, this means that the rich will carry on doing that, but only having transferred a substantial portion of their wealth to the poor. And so we see an inbuilt progressivity in this system.
You can find the details at www.monbiot.com. That's spelled M-O-N-B-I-O-T.com. His talks are available at www.ecoshock.org in the Audio on Demand Climate section. I have heard him speak live, and I came away thinking we really could chart a way out of this climate mess without going into a cave.
Ladies and gentlemen, Robin Williams on the State of the Earth.
It's the end! I don't know what's happening! There are temperatures in places that no one can predict. Even Nostradamus is going New Dealer!
Back in America, Ross Gelbspan is also a credible advocate for a new alternative economy. He starts out with a vision to install carbon-free energy tech in the developing world on a crash basis. Without that, he thinks, the massive increase of oil and coal burning in China and India and all the rest of the developing countries will swamp any changes we make here as concerned consumers in the developed world. We have to bring everyone along with the new wealth that technology can create, he says, and we can't let that happen using old-style industrial carbon pollution. His alternative is to raise about $300 billion a year for 10 years, to create a new alternative energy infrastructure in the developing world. Solar power galore, wind power wherever it works, big tidal power, even hydrogen as a transmission technology where needed. I haven't heard Gelbspan advocate nuclear power, but perhaps I just missed a speech. Where will this money come from? Gelbspan advocates the so-called Tobin tax. This is a tax on currency trading, which is believed to top $1.5 trillion a day. If some agency, he doesn't say which one, could grab just 0.5% of this trading, that would raise the $300 billion a year. It taxes speculation and transfers a small portion back towards actual production, the production of alternative energy devices. Perhaps a carbon tax or even a travel tax could work just as well, Gelbspan says. The actual mechanism of raising this tax money is less important than the imperative to arm the rest of the world with safe, carbonless sources of energy. In addition, Gelbspan wants a global agreement or decisions by national governments to increase carbon efficiency by 5% a year. A country or a company could produce 5% more goods using their current energy by increasing efficiency in production. Or they could institute energy-saving plans. In the first few years, he says, conservation would be the main mechanism to achieve the 5% annual efficiency gain. New technology could also help hit the target. But eventually, several years down the line, he thinks the end result would be an overall 5% reduction of carbon emissions year by year. In 10 years, this would cut carbon emissions in half if it works. We don't know how this will be measured or who will enforce it, but perhaps that's just a little too much detail to ask of one person suggesting a plan for a complex world in trouble. We may have to take Gelbspan's ball and run with it.
I believe, in fact, that they if they're not right in detail, they represent an example of the general direction the world has to move. And they include a change in energy subsidy policies. They include the creation of a large fund to transfer clean energy to poor countries. And they also involve a regulatory mechanism that makes every country increase its fossil fuel efficiency by 5% a year.
Ross also wants an end to the $200 billion in government subsidies to the coal and oil industry worldwide. And he specializes in hunting down scientists and front groups who create doubt about global warming on behalf of the fossil fuel industry. Find the real guts of his plan in his book, Boiling Point, available at major booksellers, and at his website, www.heatisonline.org. Heatisonline.org. You can also find his speeches at ecoshock.org. We haven't covered another British journalist and environmental activist, Mark Lynas. Watch for his new book, 6 Degrees, coming out this spring from HarperCollins. It will show the different stages that Earth might expect for each degree of temperature rise. But I don't know if Lynas adds a plan to avoid the worst extremes. His website is www.marklynas.org, spelled L-Y-N-A-S. You can find recent speeches by our 5 main climate thinkers in a special section on the Radio EcoShock website called Climate Solutions. Look for it in the audio on demand menu at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. There you will find speeches with action proposals by Al Gore, Lester Brown, Amory Lovins, George Monbiot, Ross Gelbspan, and James Howard Kunstler. We'll throw in a feature on James Lovelock, too. They're all completely free to download in MP3 format. I encourage you to explore your own future and alternatives, because these are the questions you will have to answer in the next few years, at the ballot box, at the cash register, and in your own heart. How will we save this gracious and fertile planet from the perils of our own carbon garbage? How will we save the climate? It's up to you.
Darkness song, and it won't be long before you leave them all far behind. 'Cause it's
You have been listening to Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, community-owned radio in Vancouver. If you would like to support this program, and we need your support, please become a member. That's how we pay the bills. You can call the station at 604-684-8494 or go to www.cooperadio.org. Please say you are supporting Radio EcoShock. We need your help to stay on the air. Next week, we should have another exclusive interview, this time with British author and environmentalist Mark Lynas. He's promised to give us a sneak preview of his new book, 6 Degrees, due out this March. Mark has been investigating what we can expect with every degree of heat we add to our fossil fuel economy. We'll also be heading out to tape presentations at next week's Alternative Energy Forum, being held at the Heritage Hall, 3102 Main Street, next Wednesday, January 17th, starting at 7 p.m. To find out about our alternative energy future, just show up at the Heritage Hall, January 17th at 7 p.m., and we'll see you there. Meanwhile, the hot rumor in Victoria, Premier Gordon Campbell may become greener than Arnold Schwarzenegger when it comes to climate change. There are leaks and musings in the Taiyi online magazine saying Campbell's advisors have been reading the polls. Canadians are deeply worried about climate change and want action. Though he's hardly a friend of the environment, Gordy may have to do something. Expect his plan to be announced in February. Mr. Campbell, perhaps you can begin by canceling the BC Hydro contracts for 2 new coal plants. These carbon-belching monsters will double our greenhouse gas emissions for hydro. Say no to coal. Our main show is on Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. You can also find Radio EcoShock most Wednesday evenings starting at 6 o'clock. Sometimes, like this week, you get the early edition with breaking news. Other Wednesdays are a catch-up session for those who missed the Friday edition. Radio EcoShock is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get, except you know you'll be getting all environment, all green radio, a voice for Mother Nature in Vancouver. This is Alex Smith saying see you next week on CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Splendid lady, come to call. It's the new Mother Nature. taking over. She's getting us all. She's getting us all.